Okay, I think I've got it. So what I was saying is certainly the Institute is doing what it should be doing, and it's having success. It's mounting these programs, and the programs are being appreciated. I've had several people mention to me that with envy and admiration, remarking on the facilities, and as I mentioned, the support that we've had here. And of course, it's also had some results. So let me talk about those results, at least the ones that we had in the fall semester. So what I want to do is tell you about some of the things that were discussed. I'm certainly not going to get into any technical results that were established during the semester, but I do want to put into perspective what was taking place. And one of the things I want to do in terms of putting it in perspective is answer the question, and I think it's an important question, is why this particular semester on this particular subject, and why now, as opposed to 10 years ago or maybe 10 years into the future. So let me talk a bit about history of the interaction of set theory and analysis, and I'll go over stuff that's well known, but, do that in any case. Certainly the beginnings of the subject and also the interaction go back to Cantor, who, of course, was looking at the convergence properties of trigonometric series and was interested in trying to determine or trying to characterize the sets which you got automatic continuity on. In other words, those are known as the sets of uniqueness. And it's actually the complements that have uniqueness if you converge on the complements and you converge on the rest of the points as well. And, of course, he showed that singletons and finite sets had those properties. And then he went on to try to figure out what else could be said about them and noticed there were some infinite sets which were sets of uniqueness. And in the course of this analysis, he developed or discovered, unearthed the idea of an ordinal. And together with the notion of an ordinal and the notion of a derived set, was able to give much more information, more examples of these sets of uniqueness. So that was the start. And of course, afterwards, he came up with notions of cardinality and things like that. But for the purposes of what I'm going to be looking at today, I guess one of the other important milestones was the notion of Lebesgue measure. And more importantly, the notion of non-measurable sets. And I'll just mention those now, but we'll come back to those when we're looking at some of the applications, because the construction of non-measurable sets serves and continues to serve as a paradigm for things which, together with much more sophisticated sort of analysis, are being studied intensively at the moment. The other thing, I guess the other major point in the history of the subject that you want to mention, is Suslin's, well, like I started out with, Suslin's reading of a paper by Lebesgue and noticing that there was an error in the paper. The error was, Lebesgue said, well, we've got this Borel set, and now we take a projection of it. And that projection, of course, is Borel, and he goes on to prove various things. And Suslin started scratching his head at this point, and notice that, well, there's no reason why the projection of a Borel set should actually be yet again a Borel set, and came up with examples of things now called analytic sets, which are not Borel sets. And once you've got this example of a set, you can take these complements, and those are different things yet again, and you've got a whole hierarchy of things. These are called projective sets. And so the proof, I guess, the names associated with these people, Suslin, Luzin, Alexandrov, and others. So those are three, I guess, way back, we're talking about the very first part of the 20th century. And, of course, there's the Hausdorff-Banach-Tarski paradox. Again, using set theoretic techniques, the axiom of choice, transfinite induction, to construct the well-known paradox. So this was the sort of state of affairs up until, I guess, the work of Luzin. And after that, things didn't seem to progress much. And I think the two areas, set theory, I guess, progressed at a fairly slow pace. And analysis certainly moved away from the use of any sophisticated techniques that were already developed. So the two subjects moved apart. And the reasons for that are, well, they essentially didn't have the tools available to them to analyze what was going on. So these projective sets, these continuous images of Borel sets and their complements and continuous images of those sorts of things, people back in the 20s and 30s actually were able to prove stuff, and they proved stuff right up until the limit of what they could possibly prove. The stuff beyond that, they really needed to know about inner models, large cardinals, models, different types of generic reals, overinal models, and all sorts of things that I'm not going to be talking about. But clearly, they just didn't have a chance. So it's impressive that they did get as far as they could get. And then around the 70s, once these sorts of things were beginning to get better understood, all of a sudden there was a renewed interest in the questions of analysis, and these projective sets started to play a role, and their measurability properties and regularity properties and all sorts of other things like that, became the focus of attention, and it's gone on for since then. Now, that's not what I'm going to be talking about. All right, so this is so the prehistory, the hiatus when not much was done, and then there's the start of this, the subject. And the reason I'm not going to talk about that is because that's not really what was happening in the fall semester. And I guess having explained what the impetus was for the renewed interest in set theory, some people are starting to yawn off, gee, large cardinals, inner models, I don't know what's going on here, this is all too technical. And in a sense, that's been, I guess, one of the reasons, perhaps, that there hasn't been as much interest or as much attention paid to some of the results. But more recently, let's say within the past 10 years, what has happened is that set theoretic techniques have been applied to questions that don't require any extra set theoretic axioms, don't require certainly large cardinals or knowledge of anything about inner models. The results are the sort of results that are asked about in other areas of mathematics without any reference to set theory, and the results, as I say, don't require extra hypotheses. And that is sort of a new step in this development of analysis and the interaction with set theory. And this is the reason that this particular semester was very timely. As I said, this is all stuff that's quite new, and it's a slightly different direction in the subject. So what I'm going to be talking about is a few examples of the sorts of things that were discussed, and try to convince you, and I don't think it'll take much, that this is really the sort of thing that anybody would consider to be mathematics, and it's not the sort of thing that is exceedingly technical and needs a large amount of knowledge of set theory to even understand the statements. So the first example, that I think is very nice, is exceedingly elementary. It's question in planar geometry. Now, the question asked by Steinhaus was the following. You look at the plane, and in the plane, you look at the integer lattice. That's all points with both coordinates integers. Now, Steinhaus's question was, can you find a set which picks out precisely one point from each isometric copy of this integer lattice? So you want to find a set with the property that no matter how you take this integer lattice and move it around, no matter where you move it, it will intersect your given set on precisely one point. Now, before I go on to say a bit about this, let me mention an old chestnut that's often done in undergraduate set theory type courses, and that's the following example. Is there a set in the plane which intersects each line on precisely two points? Right? Well, the way the answer is yes, there is such a set. The construction is you line up all of the lines in length continuum, and you simply go ahead choosing a point from each line. All right. Now, when you come to a particular line and you want to choose your next point, what do? Well, you look at the line. Is there a point on it? Let's suppose there is. You want to make sure that you don't choose any three collinear points. So you look at all the other lines you've chosen so far. They intersect your given line on a set of size less than continuum, so you've got lots of room to pick the next point, and that's what you do. Right? And at no point have you chosen three collinear points, and at the end you're finished. So that sort of thinking is the sort of idea, well, when you look at this question, say, sure, this should work. Let's line up all isometric copies of the integer lattice, and let's just go ahead and pick a point from each one of these things. Well, this problem's been around since the 40s, so obviously something goes wrong. All right, so this is the reasonable try, is to simply enumerate stuff. But there's an obstacle, all right? So once you've got all of your lattices, what you're going to be trying to do is to enumerate all of them, pick a point from one, and hope that you succeed. Well, what happens is, if you enumerate things and you simply pick that point from each integer lattice, you could come up with the following situation. Let me show it to you. There actually is a collection of 17 points in the plane, which could have been the first 17 points that you chose as you were going along in your transfinite induction. And now, let's suppose that the following thing has occurred. The 18th isometric copy of the integer lattice is actually the integer lattice, all right? That happens to be enumerated number 18. Now, what have you got to do? You've got to pick a point from that integer lattice, but you can't pick it from any of the other integer lattices. What does that mean? It means the distance between your point and any of the other points that you've chosen can't be the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle whose two short sides are integers, right? Because if it was, well, here's those integer sides give you, you know, the coordinates for an isometric copy of the integer lattice, and you're stuck. Well, you can actually get 17 such points. All right. All right, I'll leave it to you to check that, in fact, if you try to choose any point from the integer lattice, there's going to be one of those points which is which forms the hypotenuse of a right-angle triangle with both sides integer coordinates. So once you get up to here, at stage 18, you're stuck. Well, so the simple-minded approach doesn't work. What Jackson and Malden did, who solved this problem, was they came up with a much more sophisticated method of doing the induction, taking much more care to line things up carefully. But the heart of their construction was really some basic, elementary, but still quite sophisticated, or I guess that's a contradiction, elementary but still difficult number theory. And it also involved some mathematics from the 19th century. Part of their argument required, well, you've got these points, and you've got to look for some sort of freedom as to where you're going to choose your next point. So their freedom came about by looking at a point, a circle around it, some lines they've got to avoid, and after some work, they come up with this thing that looks like a mechanical assembly. You've got some circles, you've got some pistons connecting the circles, so you've got three circles, and I think you had three or four rods connecting their circles, and the question they had to answer was, is this mechanical assembly rigid or not? In other words, if you turn one of the circles, is the whole thing going to turn, or is it frozen in place? And what they wanted was that the thing had some freedom. You could move it around, because as soon as you could move it, you've got a whole continuum of points to choose from when you want to choose your next point. Now, apparently, this sort of mathematics of whether these things are rigid or not was in vogue in the 19th century, and various theorems were proved, but not the theorems that Jackson and Malden needed. So they actually have to go back to 19th century type of mathematics, prove some general results. They also, as I said, had to do some number theory, look at the Grosvenor bases and things like that, and in the course of doing that, they actually were able to solve this problem. So as I said, the reason I chose this particular example is you're applying set theoretic techniques. The set theory is more, well, stuff that could have been done in the early part of the 20th century, but you actually had to introduce some more mathematical techniques to really deal with this. So the interactions there are not so much on the set theoretic side. That's what motivates the problem and sort of gets you into the situation where you need to do this stuff. But after that, there's a whole lot of other interesting sorts of things to do. Now, let me, just before I leave this topic, should mention that there are a lot of open questions in this area. So here, for people who don't want to listen to the rest of the talk and want to think about something interesting, here's a result of Arne Miller and Bill Weiss. They showed that suppose you don't take the whole integer lattice, you just take 4 points, the 4 points of the unit square, and you ask the same question. Can you find a set which is going to intersect precisely one, or choose one point of each isometric copy of this unit square? Right? So you move that square around, and you want to pick out one of those things. Seems like that might be a reasonable way to approach this isometric lattice business. I mean, why, you know? Well, it turns out that you really need the lattice, that there is no Steinhaus set for the square. And you can ask the question for other sorts of geometric figures, and I think in most cases the answer is not going to be known. Certainly the answer for the Steinhaus question for the three-dimensional integer lattice is not known, and the problem is not the set theory, the problem is the mathematics, the number theory that, you know, just that you get stuck at when you're dealing with this question. So there's lots of work to be done, and I think the input has to come from areas outside of set theory, even though the basic framework for the problem is set theory. And just as a last comment, let me go back to that first sort of example I mentioned about a set which intersects each line on precisely 2 points. It's easy to come up with such a set. Well, here's a question that has been open and still is open in set theory for a long time. Can you get that set to be Borel? I mean, all of these constructions I've been talking about now are using the axiom of choice, but can you actually maybe give a very nice closed form definition of such a set? It's not known, but that's another story. All right, so let me move to the second of the topics that I want to talk about, Banach spaces. And this was really one of the major focuses of the conference. There's been an awful lot of input both directions between Banach spaces, Banach space theorists, and set theory. Now, I guess the reason, the starting point for the connection between the two subjects is Ramsey theory. And seems, I guess, one of the first sort of results showing this was this now classical theorem of Rosenthal, which characterizes the L1 spaces. There it is. Every bounded sequence, it's going to contain a copy, an isomorphic copy of L1, if and every bounded sequence in Y has a weakly Cauchy subsequence. Now, why? It's a nice theorem, but why does this have anything to do with Ramsey theory? How would you even go ahead and use Ramsey theory here? Well, let me tell you, I guess, first of all, what we mean by Ramsey theory. The classical result of Ramsey theory, Ramsey's theorem, says the following. You take the complete graph on the integers. Right? So you've got an edge connecting any two integers, complete graph on this. And you color the edges black and white, and the theorem is that there is an infinite set which all of whose edges are either white, or there's an infinite set all of whose edges are black. Right? So that's the infinite version. There are, with various bounds, finite versions of such theorems, and you can drop the dimensions from pairs to triples, and there's whole theory, vast books and various volumes written on Ramsey theory. And set theorists have occupied a lot of their time dealing with this thing and looking at it in all sorts of different ways, which is why they're interested in these sorts of questions. But let me get back to what I was talking about, which is why does this have anything to do with Banach spaces? Well, we're looking for a certain type of sequence, sort of the basic type of sequence. Well, if you want to find a basic sequence, what you'd like is something which mimics the L1 behavior of the standard sequence. Well, what do you have to do? You've got two elements in L1. If they're part of a sequence, the norm of their sum should be the sum of their norms, sort of mimicking L1. Well, we're only looking at the isomorphic question, so we're allowed to have some bounds backwards and, you know, giving upper and lower bounds on what the sum is going to be, but that's what you're looking for. So now you've got this infinite set of all sorts of things that you want to choose from, and, well, you'd like to have at least that property that between any two of them, the sum of the two looks something like the L1 norm. Well, that's exactly, or not exactly, but very similar to the Ramsey question, because what you've got, well, what you have is this infinite set of things which are potentially basis elements for your subspace. You connect any two of them with an edge, and you color that edge black if the sum of them has the right norm within certain bounds, and you color it white if it doesn't. And you're looking for a homogeneous set. Well, if you have the right sort of property, one thing happens. If you have the other bad sort of property, well, something else happens, and you deal with it. But this is the sort of thing that you're doing. Now, okay, fine, you get your homogeneous set, but that only works for pairs. Of course, we want to have an infinite basis, so what about triples? Well, you've got to have something similar happening for triples and quadruples and so on. So we're out of the realm of ordinary type of Ramsey theory. We're into things which are more infinite dimensional, I guess, Ramsey theory, where you're looking at finite sets all at once, and there are, there is a lot of information. Well, not a lot of information, but there are groups of people who look at these things, and there is quite a bit known about this. So, this is the connection between Banach spaces and set theory. At least one of the connections. Now, similar sorts of arguments were used by Gowers in his solution to this question of Banach on homogeneous Banach spaces. The question is, if you know that a Banach space is isomorphic to all of its infinite dimensional subspace, well, sorry, and let me state the result, then the point is, Gowers showed, it's isomorphic to a Hilbert space itself. Right? So this is certainly a very good result. What does it have to do with Ramsey theory? Well, there was a part of this that is Ramsey theoretic. And it says that if you have a Banach space, that it contains a subspace which either has an unconditional basis or is hereditarily indecomposable. This result is along the way to proving that result. Now, this is, in sort of general structure, similar to the first result of Rosenthal. You're talking about a certain type of basis, subsequence in this thing. Either it has that, or the space is hereditarily indecomposable. All right. So you'd like to know, I guess, where are these things? And there's the result of Gowers and Morey, which where they constructed a space without an unconditional basic sequence, and so space was hereditarily indecomposable. Can't be broken up into direct sums of subspaces. Right. So there's a list here of several very important results in the theory of Banach spaces, and outgrowths of these things were considered certainly during the semester. But one of the questions that you can ask, especially looking at this last result, which gives you this hereditarily indecomposable space, is, well, okay, Gowers and Maury constructed this space, but does it have any other nice properties? It's an abstract space. Do these spaces arise in sort of the general by generally looking at space, do they come up naturally in some way? Well, that's a question that Piotr Kozmider looked at. And he looked at the very natural class of spaces, which are continuous functions on a separable, compact topological space. Right? So this class of Banach spaces it has nice properties, the subclass of the class of all of these things. And the question that he looked at was, can you find an example like the one of Gowers and Maury, or Moray, in this particular class of spaces? Well, the answer is sort of yes. I said at the introduction that I was going to be talking about results that don't require any extra set theoretic axioms, and I, except for this one exception, that is certainly going to be true for what I'm saying. The first result is an absolute result. So you've got a compact, separable Hausdorff space, and you look at the CK space, the space of all continuous real-valued functions with the usual supremum norm on it, and you get a space that's not isomorphic to any of its proper subspaces nor any of its quotients. All right? So that doesn't require any extra set theoretic axioms. We can get even more. Now, this is similar to the indecomposability types of results of the previous space. But if you're willing to assume the continuum hypothesis, and I think Field feels that, in fact, the continuum hypothesis might actually not really be necessary here at all, but for the moment it is in any case, you can get actually even more extreme properties for this particular space. What you can get is that the bounded operators on this space are especially simple. All right? They're all essentially diagonal, G times I, plus a fairly small operator, small range, a weakly compact one. All right? So this is, again, telling you that you've got this lack of indecomposability in this particular space. So what, in fact, you have is the first example of a CK space, this nice category, which is indecomposable. And the other thing is important but not relevant not directly related to the Gowers-Moray result. It's actually not of the form C of K prime for any zero-dimensional space. But this part here is showing that the original Gowers and Moray result can very similar space be found in this space of continuous functions. Now, the techniques here, though, are very different from the Ramsey theoretic techniques that were mentioned before. These techniques are really sort of the bread and butter of set theory. You're doing a transfinite induction. What are you doing? Well, let me look at try to give you just a very quick idea of what's going on here. You look at this. The whole trick, of course, is in constructing the right topological space K. Now, a consequence of all of this that's already non-trivial is that this space has the property that even the one-dimensional or co-one-dimensional spaces are not isomorphic to the whole space. So even if you leave out, if you take a space like this, look at the space that you get by looking at all functions which are zero at a point. Right? Now that is a space that has to be dealt with. That can't be isomorphic to the whole thing. Now, the way that this problem is dealt with is you're constructing the space K and you've lined up all of the potential points and everything else in some scheme that I won't talk about. But essentially what you come to is you've got your partial space K and you've got some point in that space, which could be a point at which you're looking at all functions which are zero at that point. Right? Now, you wind up, perhaps, with an isomorphism between that and the whole space. And what you want to do is destroy that. Now, well, there's not a lot of space here for destroying this thing. You've only got this one point to work with. What you do, though, is you take that point. Imagine that your space K is, let's say, the unit disk, which it pretty well could be at some initial stages. You take that point and you blow it up so it's, let's think of it as a round circle. And now that point has become a one-dimensional object, and your functions, which before had to be zero at that point, now are zero on this disk. And now you've got a lot more room to play with this thing, and you can introduce, well, you have to do here some work, obviously, but you can introduce these functions which have really bad properties on this disk, and bad properties which will not allow that isomorphism that you potentially had before to take that to the whole space. All right? So, of course, you have to do this for each of these points. So what your space looks like in the end is you keep taking points, blowing them up, having these functions which are really nasty on these things, and blowing this thing up and taking these inverse images. So you've got this very Swiss cheese type of thing with all these holes that have been added to it with these boundaries, and you go off and you take the limit of this thing. Now, for the first result, which doesn't require the continuum hypothesis, turns out you can do that without anything extra. For the continuum hypothesis, you need some other things happening here. All right. All right. So let me talk about the third type of example that was looked at in the semester. Now, definition here is very simple. What we have is equivalence relations. I mean, really equivalence relations, the sort of thing that you look at in, you know, discrete math 101. And they're defined on some Borel space, which you could think of as the real numbers. So you've got, well, I guess it's the square of the real numbers. You're looking at a Borel relation. And we've got this relation between these two equivalence classes that you want to look at. Now, all the equation, all the relation says is that you've got, you know, these things are equivalence classes that glob together here. Here you've got some other ones. This mapping takes these and collapses them on the other side. All right. Now, this is a very simple context to be looking at. A very simple situation to try and analyze. Well, it turns out that past 10 years, I guess this work was initiated by Keklis, people have devoted an awful lot of energy to looking at this thing, which seems like, as I said, is, you know, math 101, discrete math, equivalence relations. What on earth could you say here? Well, it turns out that there's an awful lot that can be said about this particular situation. The important thing here is that we're not looking at arbitrary equivalence relations. We're looking at Borel equivalence relations, or things which have a reasonably nice definition. So the examples of the sorts of things that you would look at are, well, look at matrices which are equivalent under, you know, conjugacy or something like, or you could look at topological spaces or compact sets which are isometric, right? So there are, or you could look at certain types of mappings, ergodic mappings which have the same sort of recurrence relations. So, or operators which have, you know, similar eigenvalues. So there are, in fact, many examples in ordinary mathematics of equivalence relations, and all of those equivalence relations turn out to be actually Borel. I mean, the definition, well, if you look at any of those definitions, you can write down the definition, and it has a nice enough definition that it turns out actually to be Borel. So the subject, I mean, if it's stated in this abstract form, seems like it's totally out of the blue, but it actually has many examples that you encounter all the time. All right. Now, so I've talked about just equivalence relations for the moment. What about this relation, which tells you that this one equivalence relation, E, is less than another one, F? The way to think about this relation is that one of the equivalence relations has more information than the other one. Right? One of them, in the language of the people who look at these things, is one of them has been reduced to the other one. Now, and we'll make the obvious identification. If one of these equivalence relations can be reduced to the second one and the second one to the first one, we'll say that they're equivalent. Okay, what is this good for? Well, what you would like to do when you're looking at these equivalence classes is try to characterize equivalence relations by their behavior. Right? Now, the best sort of behavior you could have for an equivalence class is that you're able to choose a representative from each one of the equivalence classes in some very nice way. Right? That's the best sort of behavior. So, for example, the case that usually happens is if you have, let's say, matrices, you look at some nice canonical form for the matrices. Right? That will give you a nice representative from the class of equivalence, representative of the equivalence class. And notice that the mapping, which sends an arbitrary matrix to its canonical form, is usually fairly nice. Might not be continuous, but certainly has a definition. You can do some sort of, you know, row reduction or whatever, so you've got a nice method of calculating this thing. Right? Let's say, so when we're talking about Borel, let's say it's something that you can actually calculate. For our purposes, that'll be more or less the same. Or if you're looking at ergodic maps, you can look at recurrence points and things like that. That again gives you something that is an example of a way of choosing from equivalence classes something very nice. Okay. So that's, there's of course many other examples, which I'll leave you to think about, knot invariants, things like that. Those are all examples of the sort of simplest possible behavior. Now we'll sort of assume that that's the behavior that you would like to have. If you're studying something and you can choose from an equivalence class a nice representative, well, then you're happy. Then you go on and use that equivalence to do something. Often, though, you don't know whether you've got a nice representative, and you're looking at this thing and hoping for a representative. And in some cases, there aren't any. So what are the cases where there aren't any? Well, I mentioned right at the beginning non-measurable sets. Well, it turns out that the non-measurable sets give the canonical example of the situation where you're not able to choose from an equivalence class a representative in a nice way. How does that work? Well, let me remind you. How do you get a non-measurable set? You take one way, of course, is you take the rationals, and you shift them around. So you say two things, two reals are equivalent if their difference is a rational number. All right? Well, that's certainly a nice Borel equivalence relation. Can you find a representative from each equivalence class in some nice calculable way? Can you choose from each real number some number which some number which differs from it by a rational amount in some calculable way? Well, you'd like to say, well, maybe try to take the closest one to zero. Of course, that's not going to work. Or choose some number. Turns out, though, that you can't do that. Right? And of course, this is the whole point of non-measurability. If what Vitaly did was chose at random using the axiom of choice one member from each one of these equivalence classes and showed that set wasn't measurable. So it's certainly not Borel, and it doesn't have, in fact, any of these other projective properties as well. It's a very nasty sort of thing. Anytime you try to make an equivalence class choice, you've got something which you're not going to be able to calculate, not going to be able to handle in the way that you could, for example, the normal form of matrices or eigenvalues or anything like that. Now, it turns out that that's a clear dividing line in the behavior of these equivalence relations. You've got, on the one side, these very nice things, or you've got this nasty sort of behavior where you can't hope to get any nice type of representation. Now, it's that place where there's no representation that, of course, is most interesting. What are the questions of mathematics that fall into that area? What are the, essentially, what are the questions that are intractable, or the, what are the ones where it's not worth looking for some nice parameters for your equivalence classes? Well, the one example I think that I think is very nice and is sort of prototypical for the successes of this particular theory is the classification of finite rank free abelian groups. Right? So, abelian group, well, finite rank, they can all be embedded if they're rank n, they can be embedded into the n-dimensional product of the rationals. That's for our purposes what we mean by a rank n abelian group. Torsion-free means, well, there's no elements whose finite power is the identity. Now, how would you go about analyzing this class of objects using methods of set theory and even talking about Borel sets? Because after all, I mean, we're looking at abelian groups, where does the Borel structure come into play? Well, that's easy to answer. We look at the power set of the rationals simply as an abstract set. Look at the power set. That has the usual Cantor topology. If you look at pointwise convergence, or if you say take a point and take a rational number, look at all sets which contain that point, define that to be an open set. Define all things which miss an open point, define that to be an open set, generate the topology, what you get is essentially the Cantor set. Right? So that's a nice Polish space. All the notions of Borel and various other things work there. So what we look at is we look at power set of Q, or in general, power set of Q to the N, and now look at the torsion-free abelian groups in there, and you can do some elementary calculations and show that they actually form a Borel set. In fact, a closed set, I think. All right. So we've got the set of objects that we're looking at as a Borel set. Now, the equivalence relation, take two of these abelian groups, let's say in Q to the N, when are they equivalent? Well, if they're isomorphic. Now, to show that they're isomorphic is not, on the face of it, a Borel relation, right? Because to say they're isomorphic means there's this mapping, and that's not typically something that you can say in a Borel way. But it turns out that for abelian groups, if they're isomorphic, there's usually just there's a linear transformation taking one to the other, right? And that linear transformation has rational coefficients, and that makes the whole thing Borel, because it's just a simple transformation from a countable set, and you can calculate the isomorphism. So it turns out that the relation is Borel. Now, here's the question. Goes back to Bayer and even before then. Well, here's the result of Bayer. If we look at the rank 1 torsion-free abelian groups, you'd like to be able to classify those groups as to when they're isomorphic, all right? So that's what I was talking about before. Just looking at the rank 1 case. Well, how do you do that? Well, Bayer figured out a way of doing that. Let me quickly mention, just to give you a flavor of what's going on. Take any prime and take an element of the group X, and you look at essentially what powers of that prime can you divide into your element X? And you'll say the P height of X is the highest exponent N, such that you can divide PN into your X. Now, for any element X, you've got, for every prime, one of these heights. which is either an integer or, in some cases, infinity. So for an element of this abelian group, you have a mapping from the primes to the integers. Now, it turns out, by just very elementary methods, that if you have two different non-identity elements of your group, those two functions are going to agree on almost all primes, right? Essentially, the primes that are in the elements themselves, okay, are the ones where it might not work, but in everything else, it's going to work. So what you have is this relation now on these height functions, which is, let's say, two height functions agree if they agree on all except finitely many primes. And it turns out that under that equivalence relation, you take a group G, you map it to chi of x for any, or the equivalence class of chi of x for any x which is not the identity. Now, it turns out that precisely characterizes the rank 1 abelian groups. You look at that set, that height function, if they have the same height function modulo a finite set, they're isomorphic, otherwise they're not. All right? Now, this is sort of nice. It's in the sort of feels like a normal form for matrices. Notice, though, that it's not, because we didn't map to the actual function. It's not a real number that we're mapping to, and it's equivalence class. Right? So this is something slightly more complicated already than just a normal form. Well, it turns out that this relationship of being equal modulo a finite set is precisely what gives you a non-measurable set. This moving things around by the rationals, well, if you think about it, this moving these chi's around except by a finite set is the same thing. You're just moving around in some countable group. You're looking at equivalence modulo some countable group, countable dense group. So this question, characterizing the rank 1 abelian groups, is not in the really nice case where you have a normal form. It's up in the more complicated case. Now, Baer solved the question for rank 1, and you think, well, what about rank 2? Well, rank 2, there is, back from the 40s or so, sort of a characterization. Now, this was pretty simple. Characterization for rank 2 groups goes like this. You look at the p-adic fields for each p, then you look at the infinite power series over those things, then you construct certain matrices, and then you construct some sort of relationship on the matrices, and if this class of matrices, the thing goes on for two or three pages, and it gives you a theorem that says two rank two groups are equivalent if and only if these sets of matrices over these different p-adic rings are the same. And you ask yourself, probably it was easier to tell directly whether these two rank two groups are isomorphic than to go through this whole machinery. So the question is, do you really have to do that, or is there something a bit simpler here? Well, it turns out you do have to go through all of that business. It turns out that as you go up higher and higher in the ranks, you get increasingly more difficult problems, right? So the rank 2 problem is definitely harder than the rank 1 problem. So this very complicated theorem, I think, of Courage is really necessary. And when you go to rank 3, there's no even attempt been made at trying to come up with some classification, but it's going to be even worse than this business for the rank 2 case. And as you go higher, they're definitely increasingly more complicated. All right, now, the methods here, well, the methods are partially descriptive set theory. That plays a big role here. But you also use these rigidity theorems from Margulis and Zimmer and group actions and a whole bunch of stuff that comes out from a very different part of mathematics. Put all of those things together and you get these sorts of results. Okay, well, it's 3 o'clock. I know how important 3 o'clock is for tea time here. You don't want to miss it, so I'll stop here. Thank you.